Good afternoon, everyone. My name's Leslie Russell. I'm a Senior Research Fellow at the Australian Primary Healthcare Research Institute. And I'd like to start today by acknowledging and celebrating the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet. And we pay our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. So it's my distinct pleasure today to introduce Professor William Dietz, from the United States. We're delighted that he's chosen to leave the humid summer days of Atlanta for the crisp but sunshiny winter days of Canberra. But I thought before I introduced Professor Dietz to you, I would actually take a little time to tell you about the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where he was until very recently. The CDC is a public health agency within the US Department of Health and Human Services. It has an international focus and a global reputation for its research, its investigations, and its action-oriented approach to improving people's daily lives and to responding to health emergencies. We've all seen the value of CDC from, for example, the very beginnings of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, to things like the worldwide flu pandemics. Today, CDC, I think it's fair to say, is recognised as the premier agency for health promotion, prevention and preparedness throughout the world. And it comes by these public health credentials, honestly. The origins of the CDC lie in the post-World War II efforts in the United States, in the southern states of the United States, to tackle malaria. And in those days, in fact, CDC had more engineers and entomologists than it had medical professionals. Such an agency with a genuine public health focus is lacking in Australia. And as we look to tackle the healthcare issues of the 21st century, I would argue that we might well do well to emulate it. It's a strength of President Obama's Affordable Care Act that we now affectionately call Obamacare, that it recognises the key role of prevention in healthcare reform, and tackling obesity through clinical and community initiatives is a key aspect of that. Until recently, Professor Dietz led that effort as the Director of the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity and Obesity at CDC. He is eminently qualified to lead the nation in tackling obesity. It's been his life's work. He was among the first to alert policymakers to the rising tide of obesity in American youth, and his research in the field of pediatric obesity includes the first study to demonstrate the links between sitting, watching television, being a couch potato, and obesity. Here in Australia, we face exactly the same obesity issues as the United States. We have much to learn from experts such as Professor Dietz, and so I'm delighted to welcome him here today and to invite him to speak to us. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Leslie, for that kind introduction. It really is a pleasure to be here. And I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge Mark Harris and his staff who have arranged this visit and made it a very easy transition. I'm going to share with you today where the epidemic stands in the United States and some of the shifts that are occurring there that may shed light on and inform the response here in Australia. we've really been in four separate phases of this epidemic. The first was just bringing it to the public's attention and the attention of policymakers, then to identify targets and begin to implement strategies around them. And now I think we're in a new phase of consolidating those efforts and particularly turning attention back to the medical solutions for obesity. Because I think in many respects, we have better developed public health strategies than we do clinical strategies for this problem. One of the first things that we did when I moved to the CDC was to publish a series of maps that many of you have no doubt seen. This is just a summary of those maps. And the net effect of these was to compel policymakers to take this epidemic seriously, because as these projected across states, it was very apparent that we had a highly significant problem. And although these maps indicate a continuing trend in increased obesity, in fact, we are perhaps at a turning point. When we look at changes in the prevalence of obesity in U.S. men over time, and these are measured values, measured heights and weights and calculation of BMI for that, you can see that this is still increasing, and it's increasing across all three ethnic groups, non-Hispanic whites, non-Hispanic blacks, and Mexican Americans. There are no significant ethnic differences with respect to the prevalence of obesity in U.S. men. In contrast, in women, there are very substantial disparities. The highest prevalence of obesity is in African American women, the non-Hispanic blacks, the yellow curve you see at the top, followed in descending order by Mexican Americans and finally by Caucasian women. And despite what the curve looks like for non-Hispanic blacks, these are statistically flat. There's been no significant increase in the prevalence of obesity among women for the last almost 12 years. We see similar trends in youth. In boys, there's a continuing increase in the prevalence of obesity in contrast to girls, where there is no statistically significant increase over this almost 12-year period. And one of the important observations in this slide is that if you remove African-American boys from this analysis, boys, the prevalence in boys is flat. So increasingly in youth, it's African-American youth or the disparities in obesity which are related to the increase in the prevalence of this disorder. And most recently, and which gives me cause for optimism, is that we're beginning to see decreases in the prevalence of childhood obesity, childhood and adolescent obesity, both within states like California, Mississippi of all places, West Virginia, but also in communities around the country. And with one exception, one of the concerns that these changes raise is that the decreases are occurring in Caucasian youth, not so much in African American or Mexican American youth, which means that the disparities are increasing. That's a significant concern going forward. A second significant thing that we did was immediately following the election of President Obama, we published this paper that looked at the changes in the costs of obesity over time and pointed out that medical costs, and these are direct medical costs, accounted for almost 10% of the national healthcare budget. These are an underestimate of the true costs of obesity because it does not look at productivity or absenteeism. These are simply direct medical costs. And more conservative estimates than this suggest that these costs are even higher today than they were in 2008. Now, the data from the United States beg the question of why are we seeing this plateau? And I think that what we learned from tobacco is instructive. You can see here that the increases in tobacco began in 1900, and that was a relatively steady, almost linear increase up until the first reports linking smoking and cancer appeared in 1954. In 1964, with the publication of the first Surgeon General's report on smoking and health, the per capita cigarette consumption peaked and then was pretty flat until a variety of initiatives across the country began to kick in, related to a ban on advertising or smokeouts or banning the cigarettes from indoor areas. And that shift, the change in slope that you see in the 50s and the plateau that you see following the Surgeon General's report, I think are a consequence of increased awareness of the adverse effects of tobacco in much the same way that I think the increased awareness of obesity, which began in early 2000s, began to change behavior. And I'll show you some of the data related to those behavioral changes in a few minutes. The other important point from this slide is that these shifts in policy and environmental changes, these began at the local or the state level, not at the federal level. And that's also instructive and emphasizes why we should focus on institutions and communities and states today with respect to obesity. Now, when we begin to think about what kind of caloric deficit we want to achieve, that has now been informed by a very nice report from Claire Wang, published last May in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. And she pointed out that the energy deficit necessary to achieve the Healthy People 2010 goal, the Healthy People 2010 goal by 2020, which was to reduce the mean prevalence back to 5%, was only about 30 calories a day in 2 to 5 year old children, about 150 calories in 6 to 11 year olds, and 180 calories in 12 to 19 year olds. These are deficits which are readily achievable with policy and environmental modification. And I'll show you some of those targets in just a moment. But the data in the 2 to 5 year olds are particularly promising, because what we know from therapeutic interventions and what we know from community level interventions is that this group is very responsive to obesity control measures, consistent with the low deficit. But the other point to be made here is that these are the deficits necessary to get the mean BMI back to where it was in 2010. And that goal from 2010 is actually where we were in 1970. But the deficits to restore obese children to a healthy weight are much greater, and they're not deficits that can be achieved by policy or systems changing. Now, in the early 2000s, we were faced at CDC with the task of beginning to establish targets for obesity prevention and control. And those that are related to reduced energy intake, breastfeeding, and increased daily physical activity were the targets we established. Since then, we've added both pregnancy and sleep. Pregnancy, because pre-pregnant weight, diabetes during pregnancy, and tobacco use during pregnancy are all associated with early childhood obesity. And very little work is being done in this arena. These are important targets for the longer-term prevention of obesity in youth. Sleep is also an important target, and I think there's still debate about whether sleep per se or is the issue, or whether sleep is a marker for other types of behaviors, like television in the rooms of young children, or stress, or depression. But our focus at CDC in terms of public health strategies has been on those strategies that reduce energy intake, increase breastfeeding, or increase daily physical activity. It's important to mention here that changes in physical activity are not likely to reduce rates of obesity. They may be very important in terms of prevention. But the most important impact of physical activity is that physical activity reduces obesity-associated comorbidities. So that, for example, if you're obese and inactive and have elevated blood pressure, physical activity will reduce blood pressure. The same thing is true for glucose tolerance, and the same thing is true for cholesterol levels. The other important strategy that we began to employ in the early 2000s was not to focus on individual behavior change related to these targets, but to focus on policy, systems, and environmental changes. And those were strategies that we expected our communities to put into play or our institutions. And I'll just show you a sample of those in the next couple of slides. One of the most powerful things that I think we did in terms of these strategies, particularly those around decreasing the intake of high energy density foods, was to establish a procurement policy. And that procurement policy began at CDC in the negotiations around our contracts with our cafeteria, but spread to the division of, or to the Department of Health and Human Services, and finally now are spreading across government. And you can see here that these are pretty straightforward criteria to reduce calories and to reduce other nutrients that are risk factors for chronic diseases, like trans fat, saturated fat, and sodium. And when this was implemented in the Health and Human Services cafeteria, they were able to establish that not only did utilization of the cafeteria improve, but revenues improved. And despite the concerns that that the food vendors would not bid on this, there was no hesitation in terms of the groups bidding for these contracts. But as this spreads across the federal government, the other notable benefit of this, I think, is going to be that the food purveyors are going to reformulate products in order to capture that market. So ultimately, this policy, which began locally because we felt we needed to model it, is now seems to be spreading across government, and I think will be potentially transformative. With respect to fruit and vegetable intake, one of the things that the First Lady initiated was the Healthy Food Financing Initiative. This used funds from Treasury, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture to provide a revolving loan investment to build supermarkets in underserved areas and known as food deserts in the United States. Whether that actually changes obesity rates or not is uncertain, but it certainly addresses health equity. Sugar drinks are a critically important target, and you'll see in a few moments how many calories those supply, but in the average diet of a 2 to 19-year-old, sugar drinks supply about 240 calories a day with the calories that have no redeeming value. Around the country, we're beginning to see restricted access to these sugar drinks in municipal facilities and as well in institutions. For example, the Boston hospitals all agreed to label sugar drinks as red, yellow, and green, depending on their acceptability, and showed in one study at Mass General Hospital that consumption of the healthier products increased and consumption of the less healthy products decreased, and revenues increased accordingly. Another thing that I'm sure is going to happen, I'm just not certain when, and it's probably a consequence of how resistant the soft drink industries will be, but I believe that we're going to have taxes on sugar drinks at the local level first, and that those are likely to spread, because those taxes are likely to reduce the consumption of sugar drinks. There are projections about how much that would reduce obesity, but it would certainly provide a revenue source for the communities and states which are increasingly strapped for money. Years ago, we published the first paper linking television time to obesity. Since then, we focused on television time, but I think we've done parents a disservice. The mechanism by which television viewing causes obesity is through its impact on food consumption, mediated by food marketing to children. And I think that parents, we know that parents are unwilling to sacrifice television time because it plays such an important role in allowing particularly mothers to accomplish their housekeeping tasks. And I think we need to change this conversation to focus on the impact of advertising on children and the increased intrusiveness that advertising has in the lives of children. And there's some important examples. In which an advertiser has been able to download a child's contact list from their iPhone through a response to an advertisement that they've posited there, which is pretty scary in terms of the invasion of that child's privacy and the possibility that will be exploited, not just by companies, but potentially by child predators. Breastfeeding, I think, is something which is very straightforward. In Australia, you seem to have already moved substantially in terms of baby-friendly hospitals in which breastfeeding is seen as the default behavior. So I'm not sure that anything can be improved here in terms of lactation support. And in physical activity, as you have been a leader in terms of thinking about alternative forms of transport, active transport to school, I think that you're in a position similar to us in terms of having active physical education programs in which children are kept moving most of the time, or having PE teachers who are trained in administering these programs. Many states have regulations that require PE, but those are not generally enforced. And there's been this shift towards academic performance, which has detracted from PE programs, despite the fact that we now have several important sources of data which suggest that physical education programs are the recommended way to increase physical activity in youth. Now, I'd like to come back to some of the changes that have occurred with respect to dietary intake in the United States, because I think this has begun to have an impact. Now, this slide shows the total of sugar drinks, and this is not the same study as the one that I was citing earlier, but you can see among 12 to 19-year-olds that sugar drinks account for about 225 calories a day. That is not; those are not calories on top of normal intake. We don't yet know what those are. But we do know that on the days that children consume either fast food or pizza, that the numbers that you see here are the incremental increase over usual intake that accompanies the intake of these foods. So on a day that a 12 to 19-year-old has fast food, that individual has an intake of 300 calories greater than they normally would have, and pizza is another contributor. But one of the interesting things that has been observed recently is that food consumption has begun to shift in the United States. Now, as the first bullet here says, between 1999 and 2000, sugar drinks declined. We don't know exactly when that happened, but it clearly is potentially one of the things that could be shifting the U.S. population towards that plateau. And similarly, with respect to fast food consumption, if you add these up, you're certainly above those 30 calories for 2 to 5-year-olds, and you're getting close to that 150 calories for 6 to 11-year-olds. What's also interesting is that these changes have been accompanied by shifts in marketing by the food companies. The Healthy Weight Commitment Foundation, HWCF, is a group of companies that supply 25% of the calories in the United States. And a couple of years ago, those companies announced that they would reduce their contribution to the food supply by 1.5 trillion calories by 2015. That amounts to about 10 to 12 calories per capita per day. And they're well ahead of that in terms of their marketing. There was an interim report that suggests that they're already at 30 calories per capita per day below what they were near the 2015 target. But what's also interesting about these companies as part of the shift is that as a percent of sales and as a percent of their growth, the healthier products are selling better. Now, that doesn't mean that we yet have a widespread consumer demand for those products, but this is an important shift, which I think also contributes to the shifts we've seen. And we're seeing similar changes in restaurants, that the healthier products, both with respect to beverages and with respect to foods, are selling better than the traditional high caloric density foods. So I think we can make a case that in the with respect to the plateau, that these shifts in awareness, shifts in food consumption, shifts in marketing are all contributing to the plateau that we're seeing. And underway, the federal initiatives, I think, are only going to drive these further. We've mentioned the Healthy Weight Commitment Foundation. Menu labeling was part of the Affordable Care Act, has not yet been implemented around the country. But within states and communities that implemented menu labeling, the effects are clearly mixed. But one of the promises of menu labeling is that we're already seeing foods reformulated because of concern about consumer awareness of calories and the aversion that consumers may have to products which have lots of calories. Front of pack labeling is another area on which there's work going on. Whether that's going to come out of the Food and Drug Administration or when remains to be seen. The Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, competitive foods, and child and adult care food programs are all programs delivered either within school or early care and education. And there are now standards emerging for the foods that are being served in these settings, which I think is also going to improve the health and certainly the dietary intake of of our youth. Now, in terms of best investments going forward, clearly disparities is at the top of the list, as I mentioned. Sugar drinks remain an important target, and one of the battles that we have in the United States is that industry has co-opted the minority groups like African Americans and Mexican Americans who are heavy consumers of sugar drinks. And the way they've done this is to provide funds to groups like the NAACP or La Raza or the Congressional Black Caucus. And we don't yet have data which shows the addictive properties of sugar drinks, particularly the colas, in which I believe, I don't have data yet, that the combination of sugar and caffeine has a synergistic effect in terms of addicting children to these drinks. I think that would be that would blow the top off the whole sugar drink arena. We need to find and promote palatable alternatives to fat, sugar, and salt. Companies have marketed their products based on the palatability of those products. The palatability is determined by fat, sugar, and salt. And I believe the companies have backed themselves into a corner, and it's hard for them to produce healthy products when they've, in fact, channeled the taste preferences of the U.S. public to these foods that are high in fat, sugar, and salt. And I think something like that is likely going on here in Australia. We've had the great benefit of having Michelle Obama make this a national issue. Prior to her engagement in this issue, I think it's fair to say that the obesity was a problem which had gotten the attention of policymakers and gotten the attention of the medical community, but the general public was still well behind. I think that the Let's Move initiatives, which encompass a variety of settings, have made this a very central issue and enhanced public awareness. And even though these programs are voluntary, I think you can see that the number of settings that they encompass is substantial and likely to move towards a healthier environment. We've talked about screen time as advertising time. Another potential solution, which has not yet come out, but I think we need to pursue, are technological solutions to block advertising. There's already an app called AdBlocker, which does this for internet services, but we need something which would screen those advertisements on television time, which is still the principal source of screen time for children. And as I mentioned earlier, the investments in community interventions, I think, need to remain a priority. CDC's investment in these programs began in 2009 with the stimulus bill known as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And this included almost $400 million for investments in communities putting prevention to work. This was associated with a number of problems. First, we had very little time to get this money out the door, and we could not put in place adequate baseline measures that would allow us to assess the impact of these programs. Secondly, this money, which went to maybe 40 or so communities or states, was more money that they had ever had to spend on prevention, and they lacked a sufficient infrastructure to deal with those funds and apply them adequately. And furthermore, this whole notion of how to change policy, how to change environments and systems, was novel to many of these institutions. And at the time, we were so preoccupied with getting money out the door that we were not very prescriptive with what kinds of strategies we wanted those states and communities to use. And as a result, lots of those programs were very ineffective. They lacked consideration of what an appropriate target was, what an appropriate intervention was, and the time required to see an adequate outcome. We did a better job with the successor to those grants. These were known as community transformation grants, to which was added a broader mandate to look at some clinical services related to heart disease as well as depression. And the money was a more manageable sum for states and communities. And this fund reached about a third of the U.S. population around largely nutrition, physical activity, and tobacco. We don't yet have evaluation data from these programs, but I'm optimistic that these programs, which have put into place the kinds of policies that I showed you earlier related to the target behaviors, that this is more likely to have a significant impact. But these kinds of programs really have a solid basis and need to have a solid basis in community organization. And too often when we've designed programs, we focused on the intervention program or policy. That is, what to do. we've not been as effective as focusing on how to do it. And that's really the challenge. It's the implementation of these programs that's going to make a difference. And that involves a much different approach than a top-down prescriptive approach. It involves engaging the stakeholders in the planning of the intervention and establishing common measures of progress that are agreed upon by the participants. And clearly, these need to continue to be evidence-based. But the search for evidence now needs to shift to what works, because we know what to do. We just need to learn how to do it. And part of this process involves these types of strategies. I think it's clear, as we learned with tobacco, that a multi-component strategy is likely to be most effective. There's no single target which is going to reverse the obesity epidemic. And as we think about this, it needs to be a multi-sectoral approach with a focus on multiple settings and specific objectives for those settings. We've talked about the evidence base in which universities could play a critical role in enhancing these efforts. And I don't think in the United States that we've changed the perception of obesity from a cosmetic issue to a health issue, certainly for some populations. And that means we need to continue to focus on creating an awareness of risks and benefits. And obesity may be the wrong term because it has such a pejorative connotation. And people will say, well, you know, I'm 30 pounds overweight, but I'm not obese. And somehow we have to integrate this with an awareness of what the consequences are of those 30 pounds overweight. We also have tended to think about strategies that focus on obesity, and we've tried to sell them based on their impact on obesity, rather than to think about strategies that have co-benefits and to market those strategies as based on co-benefits. So that, for example, public transportation, although we know that it's going to have an impact on physical activity and therefore conceivably on obesity, it may not be, we may add health to that equation, but the idea is to promote public transport for its benefits rather than its obesity preventive benefits. And finally, too often when we've designed interventions, we don't think very much or strategically about the dose of those interventions. The dose of those interventions equals the reach, how many people it addresses, and the strength of those interventions. But increasingly, these are really important strategies. Clinical care and management is what brought me to Australia, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time this afternoon with you on this topic. This is going to be what we talk about with government in the lecture following this and the primary care conference in Sydney on Friday. But I do want to spend a few minutes on it and to give you a sense of how relevant this is. Remember that I said that those caloric deficits that we see for children are not going to reduce weight for children who are already obese, and certainly adults are in the same category. But as we think about the clinical strategies necessary for obesity, we need to recognize that we've never had a problem like obesity before, which affects such substantial proportions of the population. And the traditional or historical model of provider-patient relationship around disease control is unlikely to be effective given the prevalence of obesity. And this really requires changes in the way we deliver care that can address all elements here of the medical system. So that, for example, restructuring the electronic health record to not only flag obesity, but to provide a list of referral agencies for the providers who are dealing with this problem. Changing the design of the delivery system to consider health extenders, others other than physicians, who may be more appropriate to deliver this, and to learn how to change behavior to improve the likelihood of self-management for this problem. Too often, providers are directive rather than engaging with families or patients. But we also need to recognize that there has to be a complementarity of the what we change, how we are changing the environment to what we're trying to achieve with the medical system. And this type of integrated approach is rare. It's only beginning in the United States. We're beginning to see changes in care delivery, and here are half a dozen studies which I think reflect those differences. Two of these are pediatric, four are adult studies. The characteristics of these studies are interesting and relevant to how we change care delivery. The adult studies are both efficacy and effectiveness studies. Some of them are the two adult studies that are the fourth bullet here, are large studies which have been quite effective in terms of weight reduction, because what's so interesting about these studies is that they have relied on care extenders rather than multidisciplinary teams. And the results have been comparable to the traditional results of provider-patient interactions, suggesting that this is a much more cost-effective way to deliver care. And in two of these studies, the delivery of care remotely, either by telephone or internet follow-up, have shown results that are comparable to those within clinical settings. So this begins to address the shifts in care delivery, but we don't yet have a system which adequately reimburses for this type of care, nor do we have providers, particularly primary care providers, who are well trained in how to do this. Now, there are a variety of other shifts that I think need to occur within medical systems, and those begin with changes, as I began to mention, in terms of what the provider does. Most providers coming out of our medical schools and nursing schools and dietetic schools don't know how to start the conversation about obesity. They don't know what terms to use that are not offensive. So if our providers can't begin the conversation, how can we expect patients to change? Our providers are not well trained in behavior change. They're not well trained in use of care extenders. And these types of characteristics mean that we really need to shift the educational system substantially to accomplish these ends. And that is not a process that is divorced from changes in how we deliver care for chronic diseases. And this is what I'm going to be talking about later today. And I'm happy to expand a bit on during the question and answer session. In addition, hospitals are a key locus for change. When I was a medical student and subsequently an intern at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, the grand rounds, the premier academic event of the week, were literally smoke-filled rooms. Everyone smoked. This was in 1970, 71. And I then spent 3 years out of the country in doing research. And when I came back, nobody was smoking. And the cigarette machines were gone from the hospitals. And cigarettes were no longer being sold in the gift shop. And I believe that shift was transformative. It's not been widely appreciated in the discussion of tobacco control. But I think it began to shift the social norms around tobacco use in much the same way that I think hospitals can begin to change the social norms around fast food consumption, around the provision of sugar drinks, in much the same way that our procurement policy at CDC began to change the federal approach. So these are two elements that really need to be added to the chronic care model and incented accordingly. Now, I began to list these competencies relevant to obesity prevention and control on the part of providers. Another important area is the sensitivity to bias and stigma. In the United States, there is no more stigmatizing condition than obesity, and providers are subject to this. And we know that that when a patient feels stigmatized, they're less likely to come back for care. We also know that this stigmatization leads to impaired care, particularly for women who are less likely to have a breast examination or a cervical examination. So that this bias and stigma is not something that is isolated from the quality of care we provide, but is central to it. Another area that we need to focus on, as I mentioned, is behavior change strategies. The whole issue, as Mark has taught me in the last day or so, around health literacy is a critical element of that education. That I don't think providers know how to assess what the responsiveness or the receptivity or the understanding that patients have of the material or the strategies that we're employing with them. And as a result, we can't really hope to change behavior. Working with and within teams in terms of care extenders, I've mentioned, the use of information technology is another fundamental shift that has to occur because there's more information than anybody can possibly absorb in this arena. And how we use information technology not only to design strategies but to communicate with patients over time, I think is a new area. This problem of obesity offers a golden opportunity to begin to link clinical services and community services around the chronic care model that I showed you earlier. And physicians and providers in general need to become advocates for the community level change that's going to reinforce the clinical interventions that we're trying to achieve. We need to align our clinical services with the severity of obesity. In the United States, 8% of patients generate 40% of those costs, and yet our care system treats all of these patients as the same. And we need to be much smarter about what types of problems can be dealt with in primary care and what types of problems need a tertiary care approach. And finally, we need to focus on health as well as disease. We're very good at treating diseases, but very poor at promoting health. Now, the additional areas that I think are good investments are the whole arena of parenting, which I think we address very poorly, yet it's central to the behaviors of young children. Early care and education, which is what we call child care, is one of those places where we can begin to build that capacity and intervention. And the strategy here is to assure that parents hear comparable messages everywhere they go, so that those messages become reinforcing. I think we need to make the business case for investments in obesity prevention and care. I showed you earlier the costs of obesity, but we need to align the business case with what we can spend in terms of obesity and on whom. I mentioned communication earlier. I think that the public conversation is still not what it should be because of the use of the term obesity. But this communication strategy is as important in the public discourse as it is in the examination room. And finally, we need a continued investment in metrics, not just at the community level, but at the national level, to determine the kind of progress we're making. It was not until a couple of weeks ago when I looked at the data that I showed you related to changes in food consumption and marketing that I began to understand that, yes, it does seem that we're making progress, that we're not banging our heads against a wall and that industry's not completely unresponsive. That doesn't mean we've solved the problem, but those metrics need to continue to mark our way forward. So I'd like to close there, and we have some time for questions. I hope that our experience in the United States and some of the best investments that I've talked about there will have applicability here in Australia. I think that the work that's going on here in primary care and the rich discussions that are now occurring are very promising, and I don't think we're having those comparable discussions in the United States. So again, I'm very grateful to Mark for inviting me, and hope that this discussion today has been of use to you. Thank you.